Okay. We will go forward to case 12-1362, 12-1264, Harrell versus the American Red Cross.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Modell, is that how we say your name?
Yes, Modell.
Modell. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mike Modell. I represent the American Red Cross with my co-counsel, Michael Westcott. This is a fairly standard labor dispute. It's a contention by the board, National Labor Relations Board, that the Red Cross made a number of unilateral changes in terms and conditions of employment. Excuse me. The American Red Cross has about 17,000 to 18,000 employees. The bargaining unit members involved here is approximately 170.
You know, this case may be fairly standard in your view, but I think it's pretty notable for the fact that the parties repeatedly offer vastly different legal standards.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, Judge, I think the United States Supreme Court in the Winter decision has made fairly clear what the legal standard should be for a preliminary injunction generally, and this court has, unlike some circuits, has held that the standard equitable relief elements are what would apply in this kind of a case, a 10J case. This case was filed, the 10J case was filed by the board while the parties were negotiating a collective bargaining agreement. They began negotiating in February of 2011. The case was filed in August of 2011. Parties were making progress in their bargaining, and they continue to make progress in bargaining. At the 10J hearing before the district court judge, the board at that point withdrew its claim that the Red Cross was not bargaining in good faith, recognizing that, in fact, the parties were bargaining in good faith. There is obviously an appeal and a cross appeal. The board is appealing the denial of all the relief other than the single injunctive relief element that the court granted, and that was reinstatement of the merit pay program. The starting point on an injunction case, as the court is aware, is that it's an extraordinary remedy. It's not a remedy that's available absent making the necessary showing. Although there's no hard and fast rule that courts have used, typically in looking at 10J fact patterns, there are three types of situations that that give rise to this type of extraordinary relief. One is where there's been discharges of employees, and even the board has recognized with its memo that these type of situations, particularly where the discharged employees are the advocates for the union, that termination of those individuals can certainly chill rights. We have none of that in this case. We have no allegations of that in this case. The second kind of general area is where the parties aren't bargaining. The employer refuses to recognize the union. The employer refuses to bargain with the union. We don't have that situation here. We have a situation where the parties have been bargaining, again, since February of 2011 and continue to bargain to this day. The third general type of situation is where there's some retaliatory conduct. It may not be a discharge, but there's some retaliation, suspensions, threats of action against either the union leaders or the people supporting the union. We have none of that in this case. There is no evidence, there is no suggestion that anybody had been threatened for their participation or support of the union. Although there are the four elements that the court is aware of for an injunction, the element I'd like to focus on today that I believe is clear the board did not establish is the irreparable harm element. Yes, Judge.
Let me tell you where I think I am. It appears that in the 10J case, the assessment of irreparable harm collapses and becomes largely one and the same as an adequate remedy at law. And because of that, and because of the deference owed the agency, it would seem that the director need only demonstrate some chance of harm and not, as you have argued, a strong likelihood. So could you take it from there?
Certainly, Judge.
Tell me why I'm wrong.
I don't believe that the law is that there's this collapse of those two elements. I think the United States Supreme Court in Winter made abundantly clear that where there was the argument that a possible showing of irreparable harm was adequate, and the Supreme Court reversed on that, saying that is not the standard. Likelihood of irreparable harm is the standard. So that collapsing that would remove that element would be inconsistent with Supreme Court authority. Additionally, there is some case law in this circuit that discusses a shifting, that the burden may change where there's a strong likelihood of success on the merits, and how does that impact the irreparable harm inquiry. And the Electro Voice case, I believe, is the authority that would establish that it's this court's decision that said, yes, that occurs, but where that shifting is going on is not the showing of likelihood of irreparable harm. It's irreparable harm is a two-part inquiry. One is there likelihood, and second is the balancing of the harms. And it's that second issue, the balancing of the harms, where if this court is going to look at if there's a strong likelihood of success on the merits, is there some lesser showing that the board can put on? That's the area where the board may be able to get some lesser showing. In this case, Your Honors, there was no evidence that was admissible of irreparable harm.
Well, I think there is something that the Red Cross has ignored, and that is this. In the case of a fledgling union, there would be irreparable harm due to the delay and damage to the power and reputation of the fledgling union. In other words, the longer an employer can stall and extend, the more likely a union will lose energy and appeal. And the fact that unilateral changes were made here certainly would send a message that the employer is hostile to unions, or possibly hostile, and could send a message that the union is weak and ineffective in advocating for workers' rights, and it would necessarily cause the union to begin its bargaining from a weaker position.
Your Honor.
So that, I think, could very well warrant a finding of irreparable harm here.
Your Honor, a delay by itself that's not caused by the conduct that's being alleged in the unfair labor practice charges doesn't establish this harm to the union. There, in this case, for example, there was a delay from 2007 until December of 2010 while the process itself worked to simply get the union certified and any examinations, any reviews be concluded. That concludes.
Well, do you dispute that the union was in a lowered position or that it would have to bargain just to get back to where it was before the vote?
Probably, Your Honor, that the changes that we're talking about are changes, many of which were made on a national scale. The plans, for example, for retirement were made across the board for everyone. The plan to the health care system, health care, what was offered, was made across the board for the 17,000 employees. If the question is, would employees see their union as being ineffective because these changes were made? I think the answer is no. They would not see it as ineffective. They would see those are changes that were made that affected union employees as well as non-union employees.
But wasn't the essential effect of this injunction to change the conditions of employment to the detriment of the employees? And in order to get back to where they were originally, they have to bargain collectively. Isn't the point of the injunction to restore the status quo so they don't have to win back what they had?
Judge, that is the purpose of this
type of... Isn't that what this case is all about, or I got it wrong?
Well, this is I don't believe you have it wrong, but this is a case that's really no different than any other case where there's been a claim that unilateral changes were made by an employer. Again, I believe...
Well, you're saying preliminary to that you got to fire somebody. Well, that's obviously a more flagrant event than the changing the conditions of employment generally. But they
sure.
Both have the same effect, it seems to me.
Well, I guess, Judge, what I'm saying is this remedy is an extreme remedy. It's not a remedy that's available in every case where there's some allegation that the employer engaged in an unfair labor practice. And this doesn't stand out as a case that's exceptional, that's egregious. And, the three situations I gave the court at the start, those aren't, I don't want to suggest that those are the mandatory requirements, but when one reads through the case law, those are the situations that have allowed courts to say, yes, this is there's a basis to go from the normal way of dealing with these this type of situation to this extreme relief, this injunction.
Well, I think that Judge Roldner's question was directed or comment was directed to the idea that this is different in that this is a fledgling union. This is, you don't have any history of anything here. The union's not performed in the past, so the employees don't know how they're going to perform now.
Isn't that? And Your Honor, in response to that, if this was a situation where there was no bargaining going on, if the employer had taken a position, we're not going to bargain with this new union, I think that's a different situation.
But the changes were made before the bargaining, weren't they?
The changes were made, correct. The changes were made, most on a national level in 2009 while the process...
Right, and this election took a remarkably long time to get certified. Is this standard for certification?
Yeah, Your Honor, I don't know that it was a remarkable amount of time.
It seemed like an awfully long time.
I mean, the time period typically for certification, and then the second piece, the time period for bargaining the initial contract, it generally takes a long time. And the testimony at the 10J hearing by one of the union individuals was, a 2 to 3 year period to bargain is not unusual. So the delay issue, I just want the court to appreciate that there's delay, a lot of delay is built into the process, and that there may be frustration with that delay isn't a basis for a court to issue an injunction.
But, you know, in the brief you spent a fair amount of time arguing that, look, we're bargaining now, so 10J relief just is not warranted. But it doesn't seem fair to me for an employer to refuse to bargain and then when facing a preliminary injunction pursuant to 10J start bargaining and then claim that 10J relief isn't warranted because the parties are bargaining. I mean, that...
Well, Judge, I'd have to differ with the refusal of the bargain language because there was not a final decision until December 15th of 2010. And in February of 2011, there was bargaining that was going on, and that bargaining has continued ever since. So I would disagree, Your Honor, that there's been any refusal to bargain. And, in fact, at the hearing, that particular claim was taken off the table, and there's no request for a bargaining order even requested. And the ALJ's decision at the on the merits of the unfair labor practice charges also rejected those various bad faith bargaining allegations that there was a delay in setting up, in getting back on proposals and explaining proposals. All that was rejected by the administrative law judge. So, Your Honor, I don't believe there was any refusal to bargain ever in this case. And as to the irreparable harm, I did just want to kind of run through with the court what the evidence was. There was not a single witness that was called by the board at that 10J hearing that said they lost any support, they had any frustration with the union. There were two people that were called that were union members that were on the bargaining team, and both of those people testified, one, Mr. Witt, that he had lost no support for the union, and two, Mr. Steele, that in fact, as a result of unfair labor practice charges, his support had, in fact, increased. There is evidence that was put on by the Red Cross, which included the four declarations, and the declarations were agreed to by the parties, that would be a process that would be allowed to be used.
I'm having real difficulty understanding what the difference is between these other unilateral changes that weren't enjoined and the merit pay. How are they different? What did the judge mean when he said what practical considerations come into play? I don't understand.
Yeah, well, I think what the district court judge, and I can't get inside his mind, but there had been some testimony that on the merit pay program it had been reinstated for non-bargaining unit members, and I think the district court judge was troubled with that. I think nevertheless, we never get to whether he was correct or incorrect on the other relief unless we the controlling issue was there evidence to support irreparable harm? And I'd actually like to leave a couple minutes to for rebuttal, if I might.
All right.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Manns. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is John Manns, and I represent the National Labor Relations Board in this matter. And I do want to get to why I think...
Is this... I know you want to get to it, but I got to ask you, is this the standard time that it takes for election certification in this type of an election?
It's not standard, but if people have problems with the process, which the employer did, and there are hearings on it, the vote, in this case, I think the votes were impounded due to challenges, and it sometimes there is another case that we cited in our brief, I think it was Berkeley versus Toyota, which was even longer than here, I think it was 4 years.
So the process allows for this length of time.
Yes.
Were any of these objections or tactics that the Red Cross utilized found to be dilatory or
No. There were procedural challenges to the election, and there were no unfair labor practices, as I'm aware of, on those.
So American Red Cross was entitled to make all of the objections it made and oppose
yes.
the union as it has.
Yes. All right. I did want to get first to why we should get all the relief that we're requesting, but I didn't want to leave commented on Judge Rovner's intuitive sense that this is unfair and exactly why it is unfair. Because counsel mentions that the parties are bargaining. In a type of situation like this where you have a fledgling union who's sitting down for first contract, in the face of these unilateral changes, they would rather not bargain. But frankly, they're on the horns of a dilemma. If they sit back and not bargain, the employer is going to look at them and say, what are you doing for us? But while they do bargain, they are faced with bargaining back terms and conditions of employment that should have not been changed in the first instance. So, Your Honor, your intuition about the unfairness of this is essentially that fact. They are bargaining.
But, of course, Mr. Mance, in the background is this looming cloud from 07 to 2010 of one of the worst economic periods that we have faced in this country, and the employer can't be frozen in time waiting for the certification. They've got to keep up or get shut down.
Yes, and the employer has a choice based on the case law. And when it makes changes during this period, the law is clear that it acts at its peril. It can decide to make the changes.
That's true, but that doesn't mean it cannot act unilaterally. It's in the danger zone, but it's not prohibited from acting unilaterally.
Well, in this peculiar situation, it is prohibited in the future, although it acts in the present, and it acts at its own peril.
I guess you can sense from my questions, I'm concerned that there is this very difficult economic time going on mm-hmm. and this very, what seems to me, very extended delay, not spurious, not dilatory on American Red Cross's part, but because the NLRB was not moving with speed, and it seems like they're getting hit, Red Cross is getting hit with the consequence of both of those things.
I'm not going to venture why it took so long. I mean, we were partially responsible, but it takes time to litigate some of these
sure.
challenges.
Sure.
And while the employer is faced with these economic problems, he's capable of acting, and the law says he does so at his peril. This is not a recent development. This has been a long-standing rule of the board, and courts have endorsed it.
The Red Cross says that its turnover rate was relatively unchanged after the unilateral action. Do you have data that would suggest otherwise?
We don't have any data that would prove that the turnover was any greater than at some other period. But that really goes to the question, we are in equity, and a lot of times we look in equity for the type of determinations that, quite frankly, are not susceptible. In a factual determination, you can reach a conclusion as to who's telling the truth and what the fact is. In equity, inferences are almost have to be part of what's going on. And while it's true that people, that we're not going to say we can prove that more people were leaving than before, when you don't grant a merit increase, when you freeze your 401k, and when you reintroduce that merit increment to your non-union employees, you know, one can infer that people may well look for a job elsewhere.
That being the case, why did the judge separate merit pay out from the others?
Maybe this will get me into where I wanted to start, because I think our appeal presents a rather simple proposition.
The judge talked about, I believe, the administrative burden on the employer of rolling these things back.
Right. The health care.
How much evidence is there in a record of what these administrative problems are, or how serious they are, or anything else?
Well, I think the judge was trying to split the baby, if you will. And I think
that's pretty obvious, yeah.
But I think the problem is that he believes that you can't roll the health benefits back, but you can roll health benefits back. The nature of an interim order in a case like this, which has been endorsed by the board and the courts, is something we call a pick-and-choose remedy. And so the employees, you know, it would be unfair to put the employees in a position where they'd have to give up good benefits that have changed along with the bad. And so the order could be phrased, and usually is phrased, to rescind these changes at the option of the union. And the employees tell their union whether or not they want a particular change rescinded. And very well in this case, the employees may say to the union, don't rescind my health care benefits. I need them. But at that point, the parties sit down and bargain with an order out there that says you will do so upon request. And the parties can search for the comparable benefits that were in place before they were unilaterally changed. And that is why the district court, I don't think, fully appreciated the nature of this remedy.
Could the Red Cross concerns about the difficulty in collecting the overpaid wage increases, could that be solved by having them pay into escrow? Could it be solved?
I think under the order, I think that could be possible, where we could put it in escrow. But in order to be fully effective, of course, the Red Cross was complaining about a 2% elective amount that they would have to pay, that they've been paying to people who were in the 401k plan who could be in the pension plan. And what they're saying is, we'll never be able, if we're ordered to put these people in the pension plan, we will not be able to collect that money that we've been paying. And the answer to that, quite frankly, is monetary damages aside, are not a reason not to grant 10J relief, and particularly when those damages are accompanying your unlawful conduct. You wouldn't have had that 2% elective if you hadn't unlawfully changed the terms and conditions of employment. Much like they said, there's an administrative burden to them amending the plan. Well, God, you know, they re-amended the plan to make the unilateral changes. They had no problem then. You know, it's the same type of, you know, argument. You know, you do something wrong, you incur a cost, and now paying that cost back is sometime harm,
But it's, in many respects, a national change, and so what would be required would be a 170-person change, which could be a substantial administrative cost, and different than the type of cost you're talking about.
It could be a substantial economic cost, but there's been no showing that it's the type of cost that would be so burdensome as to require, as to balance against the harm to the employees who've lost effectively the representation of their union. I mean, I want to go back to really what the crux of this case is. This is a fledgling union. It's just starting out. It's sitting behind the eight ball trying to bargain back things that should have not been changed in the first place. And the district court, by giving us half a measure, really didn't give us enough to full, you know, the union is on the horns of the dilemma. It has to bargain. It can't sit back and the employees watch it, you know, not doing anything. It has to bargain. But in the interim, it's bargaining behind the curve, and that's the problem. That's why, you know, at the end, by the time the board issues a decision in here, the union will probably be gone. The union won't be able to represent these employees at that point because they have lost all faith in it. And that's the crux to this case. The district court, and this is where the error comes in, the district court recognized that we were likely to succeed in this case. It recognized that the unlawful unilateral changes actually caused the harm that caused the union to bargain from a hole, and yet it only restored one of them. The union's going to bargain in a hole from the other half dozen it didn't restore. That, and the reasons they gave, as I said, the health care benefits can be rolled back. They don't have to be rolled back. The employees can recognize they don't want to be without health care benefits in the interim, and probably will. But that doesn't mean you can't order them to do it upon the request of the union. And this micromanaging the collective bargaining relationship, frankly, there was no explanation of that or what the practical implications of that were. And really, restoring the status quo has nothing to do with managing the collective bargaining relationship at all. It just puts the parties back where they should have been to begin with. And that's why the court erred when it failed to give us a full measure as opposed to a half measure. I would like to get specifically to some of the arguments that counsel made. The fact that we didn't continue our allegation and we didn't carry the day on bad faith bargaining, and that's true, and the administrative law judge said that. And the mere fact that we can't prove that the parties are bargaining in bad faith, which is just a whole lot of things you have to prove, doesn't mean that we didn't prove the unilateral changes. And in a seminal unilateral change case, NLRB versus Katz, the U.S. Supreme Court said essentially unilateral changes are not bargaining. I mean, obviously, you're not bargaining about something. You're not bargaining. You know, they were bargaining. They were showing up. The allegations were that they were delaying. And so we had a general bargaining schedule. We tried to order that. And in the hearing, we realized, okay, they're meeting, you know, and so we're not going to continue that. But, you know, that doesn't mean that we agree. You can never have good faith bargaining when you're bargaining from a hole. You can't have good faith bargaining when you start off having to bargain back stuff. You'll give stuff up to get something else back, or it just is not possible. Now, along those lines, counsel suggested that perhaps there's only three types of situations that warrant, injunctive relief. One was discharges and threats and failure to bargain. Well, as I said, the unilateral changes are a failure to bargain. They are a failure to bargain about merit pay increments. They're a failure to bargain about assignment of work. They're a failure to bargain about the carryover of personal time, the ability to get 401k as opposed to pension. I just want to emphasize that there is no requirement after winter, post-winter, that there has to be a nexus between unfair labor practices and the irreparable harm. That simply is not the case. The Ninth Circuit case in HTH versus Frankel versus HCA specifically said inferences from the nature of the particular unfair labor practices remain available. This circuit in Blodern versus Francisco Foods, in a very similar setting to this case, it was a successor case, I believe. But again, successors a transitory situation, much like a fledgling union. There was no evidence of irreparable harm in that case. None. The court noted there was none and found the inferences. So this idea that there needs to be a causal link, that there needs to be direct evidence that the employer's unfair labor practices caused the harm, it just is not true. Nor is, the case that they cite, one of the cases was Glazer versus Camo. It's a district court case. And that language about a causal linkage actually went to the merits of that case, where the board for a long time has said, in a withdrawal recognition case, on the merits, you have to prove an inference. But there is no way. Hockey League is another case. It's in another circuit, a district court case in another circuit. But there was no chill in that case. And we've demonstrated chill. The court said that, recognized the fact that that union membership, attendance at union members meetings went from 80 to 80. 80 as a high to 8 employees during the course of this. That's sufficient harm. And the ARC's assertion that because there may be other reasons for that diminution of employee attendance at union meetings aside, this court in Sperlino, with exactly the same situation where it was alleged that the employer in Sperlino said, employees are not attending meetings because they changed the day, which is exactly the same thing we have here. This court said quite plainly there may be other reasons for why this people stopped attending meetings, but the district court concluded, rightly so, that the most likely reason was the employer's unfair labor practices, and just because there are other reasons does not mean that the district court itself erred by concluding the most likely reason, which was the employer's unfair labor practices. So,
but Sunday is sort of a difficult day, isn't it?
Yes, it is a difficult day. But that aside, the district court concluded that the reason for the diminution was most likely the employer's unfair labor practices. And as it was said in Sperlino, there may be a different conclusion, but that does not mean that the district court erred by concluding going another way. There's abuse of discretion. So in closing...
Before you close, Mr. Mance, didn't the 401k match get reinstated in January of this year?
Yes, I believe it did.
So is there really a live issue with that?
Well, I think we would still request the order if they're in compliance with the order, that, there wouldn't be any problem with it.
Suppose we agree with you on the cross appeal. Should that lead to just a modification of the injunction to cover other things, or should the case be sent back to develop evidence of the burden on the employer, the administrative burden on the employer, which the judge cited here?
Well, I think in this case, and we argued in our brief, that there's no reason to send it back to the district court in this case, because the district court really, really concluded everything that needed to be concluded to find that our injunction was warranted. It erred completely as a matter of law, in fact, in concluding that it had a basis for giving us a half measure. They found irreparable harm. They found the likelihood of success. There's no need to send it back to them. He just made a mistake in trying to give us half the baby when he should have given us the whole baby.
He said there was an administrative burden on the employer, but that's undeveloped. We don't know exactly what that
is. Well, the administrative burden, I don't think, was established at all. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to give you an extra minute because we kept Mr. Mance up here an extra minute.
Oh, thank you.
Lady Bountiful. Okay.
Okay. On administrative burden, there is evidence in the record. There is an affidavit that was submitted by Anna Shearer. She's the benefits person at American Red Cross, talking about, in fact, what those burdens would be. So there is evidence on that. The fact that the board says to the court there's not going to be a union here at some period of time, the union is losing its reputation, those are not facts. Those are conclusions that are unsupported by facts. The union meeting was the only evidence that arguably the board put on at the hearing. And that evidence was that there was a decline in member attendance. And that was not in a vacuum, because the person, the Ask Me person who gave that testimony on cross-examination said, yes, the meetings were moved to a Sunday. It was the only day off that most of these people had. It's not unreasonable to expect that they wouldn't be attending the meeting. So the one piece of perhaps evidence on the issue of whether there was irreparable harm that's not pure hearsay was rebutted by their own person. So the suggestion that the only plausible inference is that people stopped attending meetings was because of loss of support for the union, there's no basis for that. Any of these 70 people could have testified at the hearing that the reason I stopped attending was because of my losing support for the union. There was no testimony on that whatsoever. On the issue of whether or not the district court found that all elements had been satisfied as to all types of injunctive relief requested, I believe that's not correct. And what the court did is district court said is there are concerns that the district court had with the administrative burdens, there are concerns with this micromanaging employment relationship, and reasonably the understanding from that is the court did the balancing of harms, asked all the remainder of this relief and the relief requested. In the exercise of his discretion, the district court concluded that the board had not satisfied its burden of showing that irreparable harm based on the balancing of the harms would result
Was your evidence that there was more of an administrative burden with respect to the matters that were not enjoined than there was with merit pay? Or was it across the board an administrative burden to go back on each of the items?
On some judge, I think clearly it's greater burden to go back.
That's in the record? That's in the affidavit that you talked
about? Yeah, the affidavit addresses specific things that were benefit related. So, for example, it did not address the carryover of PTO time. It addressed the 401K, the discontinuation of being able to participate in a pension plan. Thank you, Your Honors.
Oh, thank you. Thanks to both counsel, all counsel. And as always, the case will be taken under advisement. Thank you so much.